from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's forum program in our opening hour, the United States Department of Justice estimates one in every five women will be sexually assaulted while in college, but less than 5% will report the assault to law enforcement. Several national efforts are in the works to address the issue. A White House task force to protect students from sexual assault is delivering its recommendations to the president this week. The U.S. Department of Education has launched an investigation into claims that UC Berkeley has mishandled reports on campus sexual assaults, and Bay Area Congresswoman Jackie Speier plans to introduce federal legislation to strengthen laws to combat sexual assault on students. We'll discuss these national efforts and what's being done on Bay Area college campuses. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. A bipartisan Senate group, in a letter just sent last week to the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault, is demanding more transparency in college sexual assault investigations. The task force is expected to make a public announcement next week, and local Bay Area Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier is planning on introducing federal legislation to provide stronger laws to protect students from sexual assault. In this morning's opening hour of Forum, we focus our attention on the gearing up of a mobilization to combat sexual assault on college and university campuses. And we have a whole panel assembled. We want to first go to the South Bay, where Representative Speier is joining us, Democratic Congresswoman for the U.S. House of Representatives, represents California's 14th Congressional District. And welcome, Jackie Speier.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you. Well, this bipartisan committee of senators, actually only one Republican, Charles Grassley of Iowa, they put forth these recommendations. Are they in sync with what you're trying to do? Are we on the same page there?
We certainly are. In fact, we go further. And there's a bipartisan letter from 39 members of the House as well that I coalesced, calling on the Department of Education to be more transparent about their investigations and enforcement actions. We sent that in January. Another bipartisan letter was sent to the U.S. News and World Report, in which we ask them to consider, as part of the way they grade universities, to include information about campus safety and responses to campus sexual assaults in their annual rankings. So there is, I think, growing bipartisan support in both houses of Congress.
There's also an attempt to have universities have anonymous surveys each year, and also to have other actions like making it increased federal funding dependent on investigations tied to these annual surveys. In other words, there's more data that's being obviously mined here. You want more data, period.
Well, in part, here's the problem. We have 20% of women on college campuses that will be sexually assaulted at some point during their college career. 6% of men, LGBT community, sexually harassed some 70%. It is a cultural problem. And so we've got to get our arms around it, and we've got to fix it. One of the elements of my legislation will require this annual survey that will take place, which will be an accountability measure that will give every institution the opportunity to see how big their problem is. We started doing that in the military, and we've seen greater accountability as a result of that.
It's a major problem. I'm wondering, though, Kathy Young, for example, who is a columnist for Newsday and a regular contributor to Real Clear Politics, says that 20% figure that came out of the Department of Justice is wildly inflated. I'm just quoting her here.
Right. I think talk to the victims and see what they say. I think that whether it's 20% or 15%, it's too much. The number really is not as relevant as the fact that for decades now, these cases have been swept under the rug, that victims haven't even been questioned about the circumstances, that decisions are made irrespective of what the actual conditions were in the case. So we do know that Title IX gives everyone in educational settings the protection that they will not be discriminated against. Title IX is a great hammer because it can withhold all federal funding. So that means Pell Grants, that means research grants, that means student loans. So it is a big hammer. It's never really used, but it is the hammer that brings everyone to the table. And you have seen recently where there was a complaint filed by 31 co-eds at UC Berkeley that has triggered a Department of Education Office of Civil Rights.
Yeah, I'd like to hear you discuss that in a little more detail. We're going to hear actually from somebody who represents the University of California, Berkeley. And I know you, it's my understanding you spoke with some young women directly who were involved in this. So what's the picture you get?
Well, first of all, I met with Chancellor Dirks at UC Berkeley, and we had a very robust conversation. I think he's very committed to fixing the problem at UC Berkeley. And then we also met with many of the women who actually filed the complaint. And they are very impressive in that they've done their homework. They know precisely what it is that they want. And I think the university, at least I'm hopeful the university is going to respond in kind. They complained about very fundamental issues, such as not being told whether or not there was any action being taken against their assailant. They were complaining about the fact that they were never even interviewed about the incident, all of which sounds to me like it was just not well handled in the past, and they're going to have to redouble their efforts to make sure that they handle these cases seriously.
So we need better investigations as well as better reporting. I mean, that's ultimately pretty clear here. We also maybe need more disclosure into the kind of mishandling that's being done by colleges of sexual violence on campuses?
Right. So I think having U.S. News and World Report consider it in its rankings will be huge. My bill also is going to require that there is a public disclosure of resolution agreements, as they're referred to, where there has been an audit of a university and whatever the agreement is, the steps that the university is going to take in order to resolve the issue with the Department of Education. It's also going to require that if complaints are closed out with no action, that those are going to have to be disclosed as well. The bill also provides another $5 million per year to the Department of Education so they have additional investigator resources available.
Talking to Congresswoman Jackie Speier, Democratic Congresswoman with the U.S. House of Representatives, who represents California's 14th Congressional District and serves on a number of committees, including oversight of government and government reform, as well as being vice chair of the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, and now being involved in spearheading some legislation, federal legislation, to better deal with campus sexual assaults. I'm just wondering, Jackie Speier, also about a couple other things that have surfaced. There's talk about an online searchable database of complaints and compliance reviews and investigations, and also of, I think, I hesitate to use the word, but possibly a czar, that is one person to oversee national policy on rape and sexual misconduct and harassment.
Well, certainly within the Department of Education, under the Office of Civil Rights, there needs to be someone who is indeed the point person. I think what's most important is that at each university, there is supposed to be a director of the office for Title IX. It is very hard in most college campuses to find that individual. When I was at UC Berkeley, they went through their website and how they have refashioned it so that victims can easily access that kind of information. One of the other things the bill will do is require that there be public posting, notices in public places of what your rights are in terms of Title IX and how you can file a complaint if appropriate.
Does that include men? Because there has been a complaint filed by a young man under Title IX.
Yes, absolutely. And as I indicated, I think something like 6% of those who are raped on college campuses are men.
Jackie Speier, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Let me now mention someone else who is joining us for the, at least to respond to Representative Speier. That's Claire Holmes, who is Associate Vice Chancellor of Communication and Public Affairs at UC Berkeley. Claire Holmes, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Concerned about what you heard from Representative Speier about UC Berkeley?
Well, actually, we do applaud Representative Speier for her efforts, and we really wanted to have everyone know that we care deeply about this issue and that any kind of sexual assault on college campuses is completely unacceptable, much less anywhere in our society. So there has been a lot more national attention to this, but we are not sweeping anything under the rug here at UC Berkeley. And we work very hard to inform people and to educate our students and our entire community about what is acceptable behavior on the Berkeley campus.
When you say you're not sweeping anything under the rug, I mean, can you be certain of that, incontrovertibly certain of that? I mean, things get swept under the rug sometimes without officials or administrators knowing they're swept under the rug.
Well, I think that this issue is still stigmatized, Michael, and perhaps there are people who don't come forward. Unfortunately, even in today's society, there is a stigma to this topic. And what our job is to do is to really provide an environment where people are able to come forward to find resources and have access to the kinds of help and assistance that they might need, whether that's to criminally prosecute somebody or to get emotional support. And I would just even call out today is National Denim Day, which commemorates a lawsuit that happened in Italy where the victim was actually blamed in part for wearing tight jeans, which is completely sickening. But on our homepage on the Berkeley website today, we're commemorating that and we're trying to draw national attention to this issue. We applaud the women who have come forward and their bravery and appreciate the efforts of the Congresswoman as well.
Quick question, though. What about false allegations?
What do you mean by false allegations?
I mean, there
are forward and it didn't happen?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, certainly we do unfortunately hear of those. They may be anomalous, but they do happen.
Well, that's why we have a process by which people go through and there is an investigation. And so, you know, it doesn't. I mean, that's part of the process. People have to go through an investigation and determine what did or didn't happen.
Well, I appreciate your coming on with us, and I thank you. And Representative Spear, I think, made it very clear that you have been cooperative, and I think she expressed her appreciation of that. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Again, that's Claire Holmes, who is Associate Vice Chancellor of Communications and Public Affairs with UC Berkeley. Joining us for the rest of the hour here in studio is Peter Novak. He's Vice Provost of Student Life at University of San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Rose Carlisle, who's Community Education Coordinator of Bay Area Women Against Rape. Welcome.
Hi there.
Glad to have you both here. Rose Carlisle, let me begin with you. The author of a study that was released recently on sexual violence, Heather Holafka from Marquette, says essentially, she's an assistant professor in criminology and law, that she's finding that young women are normalizing this kind of abuse. And by that, she means harassment and saying essentially that it's the way heterosexual relationships work. There's a whole article about this in Salon.com. And there's a larger context of this feeling maybe they won't be believed by authorities or their peers and will experience shame and stigma. I mean, all those have to be seen in the whole equation of this, but are you finding that generally in terms of maybe reluctance to come forward?
Absolutely. That is a massive, massive part of the problem. Women, men, really any kind of identity, there's serious problems of underreporting, and there can be many, many different cultural factors that contribute to that. And when I say cultural factors, I really mean anything that contributed to this person's worldview. So the idea of rape culture is really integral to that. I think that's kind of an extension of what you're saying.
I'm wondering, though, about RAISIN, the group Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. They're the nation's largest anti-RAIN. I'm sorry, I put an S in there, made it. The largest anti-sexual violence group in the country. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking right at their website here. It says, rape culture has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, so I think I did read a statement from them, and they're for me at least, and for our organization, it's really a yes and issue. The idea of rape culture is definitely integral to the problem, as is the action of specific perpetrators. So you can't really separate out one from the other, because even if you, for instance, caught all of the people who are perpetrating rapes right now, which we know is a smaller percentage of people. Not all men are rapists, even though statistically, as we understand,
most rapists are men. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But if we took all those people out of the population, rapists would still come into being after that. The culture does support and create rapists on some level because of the way that it responds to people who come forward. And because of the normalization of objectification, especially of women, but certainly of other people too.
So lots of victims just don't know how to respond. I mean,
absolutely.
This is an education problem, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And at USF, Peter Novak, mm-hmm. Underreporting is the rule also, as it appears to be at so many colleges? I mean, can you gauge that?
I wouldn't call it the rule. I would say, yes, there is underreporting at every college campus across the country. But we have efforts in place to do as much as we can, not only for the student population, to ensure that they know where to go, but mandatory reporting for faculty and staff. And that's part of Title IX, and that's part of the Campus Save Act, is that you have to provide prompt and effective remedy. And that means that people who know about it need to tell somebody who can do something about it.
We've been mentioning Title IX a number of times, but also the Clery Act comes into play here.
The Clery Act and the Campus Save Act, which is the Sexual Violence Elimination Act, is actually part of or inseparable from the Clery Act and the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. And so the Clery Act, now we've got a whole system of regulations, rules, and policies and procedures that we need to follow. All campuses across the country need to, and it's been a very serious issue. And I think at every conference I've been to, it is the number one issue that people want to do better at college campuses. The number one issue that's the largest, you know, in any conference that you go to. And so there is a desire, and there's a desire among the student population. A big group, grassroots student effort called Know Your Nine, which has students who really engage their administrators in having a process that is transparent, open, fair, and victim-centered.
A lot of this is, as we said just a moment ago with Rose Carlisle, a process of education. And I know campuses, and I believe your campus is one of them, are working on harm reduction and
yes.
Working especially to make students more mindful and aware of these cultural issues mm-hmm. as well as harm reduction models. Yeah?
Right. You know, a harm reduction model helps to educate students. I firmly believe that there are two ways of approaching it. One is harm reduction, educating students on the policies, procedures, things that they can do to help themselves. Understanding consent and what consent really means, how to get it, how to give it. But harm reduction models actually don't provide the whole picture. You have to look at also addressing the culture on campus. And about 15% of our incoming male students, you know, sort of subscribe to ideas about rape culture. They'll say, for example, that if a woman flirts with a man all night, she owes him something physical at the end of the evening. And 15% of our incoming freshmen actually believe that.
Or if he pays for a meal, or if she's wearing a short skirt, or any of those kinds of things translate
right.
somehow into...
That's right.
Yeah.
And we developed a very comprehensive online program together with a company in Walnut Creek, Campus Clarity, that really combines harm reduction models with bystander intervention techniques and ways to address the issue so that we have a baseline for all of our students when they come into the university.
How effective, Rose Carlisle, do you think these programs are in the short run as well as in the long run?
Well, it really depends on the program. The bystander intervention is definitely an area that creates a lot of impact because if we do know that a small percentage of the population are actually going to be the ones perpetrating, a lot of the culture that contributes to rapes not being reported, the survivors not being supported, is the actions of the people around them, which can be intervention during the actual act itself, leading up to the act, and then afterwards. How do people respond? How do people even know how to respond? Understanding issues around consent is key as mm-hmm. well.
Understanding no means no, above all. But a lot of these get murky in terms of incapacitation with alcohol and often these are people who know each other or dating. I mean, there are some ambiguous areas here, to be sure, wouldn't you say, Peter Novak?
Absolutely. Acquaintance assault, dating violence, domestic violence are all things that we are now required to educate the students about. And consent is actually a very, very difficult topic. We are expecting our 18 to 22-year-olds to engage in conversations about sexuality that we haven't really trained them adequately to do in K through 12 education or in our homes or with families. One of the things that San Francisco WAR, Women Against Rape, does when they come to campus and work with our trainers or our investigators is ask a question about turn to the person next to you and share a positive sexual experience that you've had. And the difficulty in doing that alone, let alone a negative sexual experience, is incredibly difficult. We don't talk about these issues enough. And, you know, we're a Jesuit Catholic school. And I think the expectation from students is that because of that, we cannot talk about sexual relationships. And I think we have a duty and an obligation to do exactly that and to provide the kind of data that Congresswoman Speer is talking about and the transparency of the process and the procedures, as long as they are victim-centered and really are clear, and we will change culture.
Well, that seems pretty optimistic. I certainly hope you're right about that ability to change culture. The fact is, this often seems to boil down to case by case, though, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Rose Carlisle, yeah.
Well, there's a couple things. First, I just wanted to address something that you said about, you know, no means no kind of being the ultimately. And I certainly think while that has been something that is widely accepted now, in reality, the shift in consent culture really needs to be one towards yes means yes.
That's right.
Because that the confusion, I think, for a lot of people is that maybe if somebody doesn't say anything, that's consent.
Yeah. That's
right. And really, yeah. Consent needs to be this ongoing process throughout every step of any kind of sexual interaction, even if it's just the first physical contact that you're having.
I mean, like
somebody.
They had at Antioch a number of years ago where, you know, if you're going to put your hand there, you have to get permission.
That's right.
You know, first base gets permission, second, whatever.
Right. And it sounds a little bit ridiculous, but that's only because our cultural standards are so different from that, not because naturally it sounds ridiculous. It's just because of what we're used to, you know?
Yeah, we call it the Braille method because a lot of men feel that they'll do something and if they don't get a response, they're okay to go further. And if they don't get a response, they're okay to go further. And we try to counteract that and say, you really need to look at a variety of nonverbal cues, and you need an active yes. That's part of consent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you have to go about. See, and again, though, we're trying to inform students about how to do this. These are good practices that adults, that you can use after in relationships to say, you know, is this okay? Are we doing good here? You know, checking in with your partner.
I mentioned before an article by Kathy Young, who writes for Newsday, and the article is titled "The White House Overreaches on Campus Rape," and she says that the study that was done a number of years ago, a national study of rape from the National Crime Victims Research and Treatment Center, says 3/4 of the female students who were classified as victims of sexual assault by incapacitation, meaning alcohol usually or drugs of some kind, mostly alcohol, did not believe they had been raped. Now, again, we have to. This gets very murky because. They may have been raped, but in their own mind, somehow they were. It goes back to that study out of Marquette in many ways. But in many instances, of course, rape would be too strong a word to use. You get into, that's why I said maybe incident by incident or case by case.
I think every case at the university level, and I applaud Congresswoman Speer and Claire McCaskill, who has sent out surveys to 350 universities to look at this on college campuses. Every single incident is completely unique. The situation around it, how we deal with it, and that's what makes it so complicated for college campuses to deal with. You know, Cal has 35,000 students or is the size of a small town. We are cities within cities, and making sure that we've got structures in place to deal with effectively are the most important thing.
Let me do this. Let me invite listeners to join us. You may want to weigh in here. This whole sense of young women normalizing abuse or harassment and the whole problem of sexual assault, as pervasive as it is on college campuses, is really a serious problem that the White House is attempting to tackle. And Congresswoman Speer, you heard from earlier, we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting any questions or comments right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue with Peter Novak from USF and Rose Carlisle from Bay Area Women Against Rape, and with you, our listeners. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Efforts are underway to ramp up combating sexual assaults on college campuses, and according to figures that have been released by the United States Department of Justice, One in every five women will actually be sexually assaulted while in college, but less than 5% will report the assault to law enforcement. We're talking with Peter Novak and Rose Carlisle. Peter Novak's Vice Provost of Student Life at University of San Francisco. Rose Carlisle is Community Education Coordinator of Bay Area Women Against Rape. And I want to get to something, I want to hear from a student as well here and hear from our listeners, but get to something that I think is important to get to, and that is Representative Speer, Congresswoman Speer, who we had on earlier, mentioned the connection to U.S. News and World Report rankings, and those are very important for colleges. They're kind of ludicrous in many respects. We've done programs on them in terms of the criteria. That's my own editorial opinion. But they do have a great deal to do with attracting students. And, of course, so does whether or not students have are being sexually assaulted on campuses. And there was a major story out of Mills College a number of years ago, I'm sure many listeners remember, about supposedly problems along those lines that hurt enrollments. And enrollments can be hurt if things aren't reported or if they are reported. I mean, you're kind of in between the devil and the deep blue sea here. Peter Novak, I mean, how do you process through this, so to speak? I mean,
I would agree with you that rankings are problematic in the way that they go about them. And I'm not sure how the congresswoman wants to enact a rankings profile for a university. If you have a lot of reports on your college campus, this is something I tell our board of trustees. That's actually a good thing because we are encouraging a culture that makes it
important
and helpful.
It's a good thing, but it scares parents away.
It does. And I'm very upfront at admissions events. I will say to parents, we address issues of alcohol, drug, and sexual violence, and it very upfront, and I'm honest with them from the beginning. I say we're very proactive about it, that every school, no matter where they are, has issues of underreporting and sexual assaults, but you should feel comfortable sending your student to USF because we have a very proactive policy, and we engage the issues head on. And I think if you're out front and open about how you do it, and the more transparent you are, the better you are as a university.
Rose Carlisle, let's hear from you on this.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true because the reality is that there probably, likely, at least statistically, there is not one thing that will fix across a population or a group of people immediately the occurrence of sexual assaults. It's a slow process. It's an ongoing process. So if there are areas that are where we're having drastically low numbers of reporting right now, based on what we know about the culture, it's likely that those are just assaults that are going unreported. So it is. It's a tricky line to walk because on one hand, you want to make sure that you are working towards overall lowering the incidence while at the same time knowing that in an immediate sense, the most important thing in addition to that is going to be creating a culture where people feel safe to come forward.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring Katie Palmer into this discussion. She's a senior at California Polytech State University, and she joins us by phone from the Cal Poly campus. Katie Palmer, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you, and interested in hearing from a student's point of view what you've got this distinct point of view of Cal Poly, to be sure, but what things look like as far as ongoing concerns about sexual assault and rape on campus.
I definitely agree with the two previous people who spoke about the sexual assault climate on this campus in terms of reporting and the numbers that are shown. What we find on campuses, what I find on my college campus, is that the university is more concerned about our appearance to people who don't quite understand that higher numbers mean that we're actually doing a really good job at providing support and services for people. Because it's scary, because sexual assault is scary and no one talks about it. But what that in turn does with having these low numbers is makes people afraid to come forward and talk about their experiences with being sexually assaulted. But it also perpetuates this culture of victim blaming and slut shaming that makes people not believe people, survivors, and their stories. So it's very problematic.
Do you think, just from your own experience, these Department of Justice figures of one out of five have come under some scrutiny? I mean, just from your own experience, and I realize this is anecdotal, but friends, acquaintances, does that seem to be too high or too low to you, or what does it seem like?
So I actually was brought into this realm with a one in four statistic, and so one in five seems to be just right. Someone talked about underreporting, and I think that definitely needs to be taken into consideration that not every sexual assault is reported. In fact, most of them aren't. But I do think that it is a very, very prevalent on campuses.
And you would include your campus, obviously.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Katie Palmer, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Katie
thank you.
Palmer, again, a senior at California Polytech State University. Actually, we'll keep her on. Katie, are you still there? Well, let's get her back. We may want her on the line here to further some ideas that we're going to have, and certainly with our callers we're going to hear from. Let's hear first from Joni. Joni, you're on. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
This topic was, I was really surprised to hear it. A couple of weeks ago, my daughter called me from college and told me she was raped.
Oof.
And the situation is very complex. I believe that the culture of fraternities and sororities really, and drinking really accelerates this sexual aggression. My daughter had gone to a frat party, and there was a lot of drinking. Apparently started making out with some guy, and then she has no recollection at all what happened until the next day when she found herself in a totally different location and she had been raped.
I'm afraid she was roofied from the sounds of it, which is, again, all too common. I'm terribly sorry to hear of her experience. What are you doing about it?
Is that for me to, when I of course encouraged her to report it, but she's looking at an interrogation, which is going to have all these people saying, oh, so you were making out with that guy, so therefore you wanted it, you know, and it's shaming. It's public shaming.
There has been a lot of that, but I think universities are doing better on that score, and so are young people, at least so it would appear. But what about the fraternities? And this, I mean, let's go right to this problem, Rose Carlisle. I mean, some people say the fraternities get a bad rap. Some people say they don't get enough of a rap. They say the same about jocks. I mean, that's all part of what you described before as maybe a rape culture and a subculture. So.
Well, let me clarify. When I say rape culture, I'm actually not talking about a subculture. I'm talking about our culture as a whole and the ways that we all participate. Some may have more awareness of the ways that they can not participate in a rape culture, like we talk about issues of victim blaming. And in terms of the Greek system, I think it's a complex issue. From what I have heard, specifically on the Berkeley campus, recent studies suggest that it's possible that up to 53% of the assaults that happen on or around campus are happening in connection with the Greek system. But again, the statistics of these nature they're helpful on one level, but also it's hard to know based on underreporting issues, based on so many factors, whether or not they're really reflective of the reality.
Can you give our caller, Joni, some advice or some supportive notion of how she can help her daughter in this situation, not go through what may be a grueling experience?
The most important thing, I think, is just to probably be supportive of whatever she's going through and whatever choice her daughter makes in terms of reporting. I think that while it is really important and there's a lot of emphasis placed on reporting, for us, at least at Baywar, we really emphasize the safety and the control of the person who has survived the assault, because sexual assault on a very, very core level is really not about sex at all. It's about power and control, even though the act itself may be sexual in nature. So to really give power back to the survivor through any means possible is going to be the most important and kind of overall umbrella way to support anybody who's a survivor of sexual assault.
And I would go further, Michael, and say that it sounds like she hasn't reported yet because of a fear of a system at the university. I think the mother could call and find out what the process is. They should have an intake process, and they should have counseling and psychological services available that can have anonymous, the student can feel very free to talk about the issues. She can also come back at any time to file a report. She doesn't need to file a report now. She can, as she's going through the healing process and discerning what has happened to her, come to the university at any time to file a complaint. She can also ask the university to put a do not contact order on the person that she thinks has raped her. She can change her housing or classes if she is in those situations if she's in those classes or near housing with the student that she believed assaulted her. All of those things are in place right now and available to that student if she wants to take advantage of them now.
Joni, good luck to you and good luck to your daughter, and thank you for calling us. I've got a tweet here, Peter Novak, from a listener named Pam. It says, can you explain why assaults on a college campus aren't handled by the police in the city the campus is in?
So there are two different processes that are in place. It depends on your college and university. Some universities actually have police forces that are connected to the city and so have a civil litigation possibilities connected to them. At other universities, you have non-sworn officers. So there are two processes. One is the civil litigation that you can go through, and the other is a campus process. And that's the one that we're talking about here on campus most. We have to have in place investigators who go in and make determinations in order to help the victim's education. Title IX requires that we don't do anything that interferes with a student's education. And so sexual assault is a major impact on a student's whole process. And so we have to have a separate process that has a different burden of proof, by the way. A preponderance of evidence, or what I like to call more likely than not to have happened. That gives us more flexibility to act, to impose sanctions on someone who may have been a perpetrator, to remove them from the university setting altogether. But it also gives us a really sound way to help deal with the victims and to support the victims through this process.
And Peter Novak is Vice Provost of Student Life at the University of San Francisco, and Katie Pomeroy, released you a little prematurely there. I didn't realize you were able to stay the whole time with us, and I prefer that, and thank you for that. I'd like to go to you on this just to get your read about what holds back students, for example, from coming forward along the lines of the last caller we heard with her daughter. Her daughter didn't want to go through a lot of that, and that often is a stumbling block, a major one, isn't it?
Right, yes, absolutely is. And it's a multifaceted issue. So first of all, what students I think often find that experience sexual assault is the fact that students or their friends or family won't necessarily believe them. They'll ask those questions of what were they wearing or what were they drinking or how much did they drink, rather, and whether or not they were making out with him. And so all these leading questions that kind of build this atmosphere of disbelief that their experience actually was sexual assault. So that's one thing. So, and I actually want to congratulate the parent who called in, because believing your daughter is the best thing that you can possibly do to support someone who's experienced this. So the second aspect of this is the law enforcement itself. And so officers will sometimes ask the same types of question of how much were they drinking, or where were they, what were they wearing, who were they with? And these leading questions that make the survivor feel like they're not validated in what they actually think happened. And so I think that those two factors together, combined with the fact that if it happened on campus under query, oftentimes the police will have to issue a security statement to campus, letting them know that, or letting the entire campus know that a sexual assault happened, say in a dorm, that can be an incredibly embarrassing process and a horrible experience if it gets out who the perpetrator was and who the victim was. And so those factors, I think, play a huge role into the reluctancy to report.
And again, Katie Palmer is a senior at California Polytech State University. We asked our listeners, by the way, on social media what they think would reduce sexual assault on college campuses. Let me give you some responses. This is on our Facebook page, and you can add your voice to this. One listener writes, talk to young men frankly about the situation, work to change the culture to a place that does not accept assault as normal. Lisa says, litigation works every time. Thank you, Anita Hill. Natasha writes, I think the verbiage is misleading. The goal is to curb reported sexual assaults, even with legislation and sensitivity training. Actually, this describes asinine sensitivity training. I couldn't read that word. Institutions are still going to try to find ways to make it appear as if rape and sexual assaults are not problems on their campus. Let me bring another caller in, and that's you, John. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. My daughter was going to San Diego State. She called me one night. She had been sexually assaulted on a date with a guy who lived in the same building as her on campus of San Diego State. She called the San Diego Police Department, and they told her over the phone that there was nothing they could do. It was his word against hers, and they didn't even take a report. So, you know, she was concerned living in the same building as him, so I went down there, and I convinced the young man that he should leave the building or else. That's the only way I, you know, that I could, you know, contribute to it. But I was amazed that the police department didn't do more, you know, for the incident.
Well, were you threatening with the young man? They could have gone after you, right?
Well, yeah, they could have, but there was no witnesses, so I was safe.
Okay. It's a tough problem, and so many of these problems come up tough. But what about, let's get your perspective here, Rose Carlisle. I mean, so many times they do say, the police or even campus administrators, he said, she said, you know, there's no way to tell.
Yeah, well, and the unfortunate reality is that because of the often private nature of the act of sexual assault.
Like the gentleman said, no witnesses.
Exactly. Yeah. That is unfortunately a lot of the time the case. And at the same time, police still have a responsibility to take a report of the assault. Because the reality is, it's not their job receiving a phone call from somebody to decide in that moment, will this be something where we can press charges? That is something that should happen later on in the process. It's an important part of encouraging people to come forward. Thankfully, certain police departments, kind of depending on where you live and depending the experience of the officers, if they do have more experience with sexual assault, if they have to go through that division on their rotation, they often will respond better by taking those reports whenever they come in. And that will help create a climate where people are more likely to come forward and feel safe in their interactions with the police.
I think it's safe to say, and I'm coming at this from my own recollections, that it needs to be said, we've come a long way. I mean, not only in terms of police work and sensitivity of police, but also adjudication, and certainly also what we're hearing, you know, from Vice Provost Novak and others, the university's responsiveness. I mean, it's still a terrible problem, but we're doing better. Murphy writes, are there any numbers about alcohol consumption on campus related to sexual assault? Should that not be a big part of the culture of responsibility and ownership of your body? It seems like that would be low-hanging fruit.
Yes, there are. About 60%, I would say, of college sexual assaults occur when one or more or one or both of the parties have been consuming alcohol. And so it is a chronic problem. And we address that in a comprehensive, you know, orientation program that students are required to take before they come to campus. It's called Think About It. And we've got about 70 other universities who are using it now. And it combines issues. For example, if you combine energy drinks with alcohol, you are more likely to be assaulted or to commit sexual assault because of the way the caffeine and the alcohol interact in your body. And you don't know actually how incapacitated you may or may not be. So we try to educate students as much as possible about knowing their limits with alcohol, knowing what a standard drink is. We have a blood alcohol calculator that's in the program where you can calculate your body weight and figure out, you know, what it means. And if you drink more than 3 beers in an hour, it will say you may be incapacitated and unable to consent to sexual activity. And so we link those two very consciously throughout the entire program without trying to blame and while still trying to be sex positive throughout the entire program.
I'll read an email from a listener named Sally who writes, I had a very frightening experience at Stanford 2 years ago. Driving across campus at night, a young woman came running out of the darkness screaming, help me, almost landing on the hood of my car. A man had grabbed her as she was jogging and tried to drag her into the bushes. When I called the campus police, it took them close to 45 minutes to respond because they couldn't find a major intersection. Campus policing had been outsourced. And their first question when they got there was whether the young woman had been drinking. Then they insisted that if they couldn't interview the attacker, who was long gone, then it was really a he said, she said situation. The reality is that many campus police forces are not prepared to do the job that expect them to, and that if a student, male or female, is sexually assaulted, that rape exams and collection of evidence will not be available nearby. I think she has a very good point there. Probably about most campus police not necessarily having that kind of training. Another listener writes, I would like to suggest to your panel that they must include sexual misconduct, harassment, or whatever it is being currently called by faculty. I'm a recent graduate of State College in California, postgrad actually, and the Cal State I attended handled this by simply changing my advisor to a female one, and the male professor who chose to use his office hours with me to consistently solicit me for a date and to regale me with his marriage problems and his search for a mate continues his job suffering no consequences from his behavior. I do not presently feel that the state takes conduct and problems like this seriously, but it almost derailed my education entirely. Another comment online, I think a huge barrier to college reporting based on the campus sexual assault reporting policies is that they require students to retell their stories over and over, reliving the traumatizing event.
That's right. Yeah, we try to have a process where we don't force a victim to retell the story over and over again, or have a hearing board where a student has to sit there and face her accuser or in any way like that. We have a completely different process that tries to get the story once as thoroughly as possible and then explains options along the way and provides support along the way.
Another comment from Lance, who writes online, the binge drinking culture creates most of the opportunity for sexual assault. Would it really hurt universities to disband campus fraternities? You said, Rose Carlisle, before 52% maybe, or we heard that, I'm sorry, that figure thrown out about fraternities and the subculture and whatnot. Banning fraternities?
You know, I think that's a great question. It's hard to know what kind of impact that would have. I think it's probably impossible to speculate. I certainly think that it's a piece of a very, very complex and multifaceted problem. And so the likelihood that increasing regulation or banning fraternities or doing something that's more drastic, it would certainly have a large impact, I would speculate. But my guess would be is that it's certainly not going to eradicate or likely even get rid of 50% of the problems.
There's a big article in recent Atlantic about fraternity culture that's really quite revelatory, but particularly in terms of how these national fraternity organizations
responding
bring a lot of pressure one way or the other. There's a lot of money there. I mean, it's like the alumni, you know. They're the ones who help support and indeed support the universities. Let me go to another caller. Saba, that's you. Hi, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So as someone who experienced sexual assault as an undergraduate, I just want to – it's interesting to me to hear that reporting is kind of the metric that we use to determine whether or not we're handling sexual assault cases properly. In my opinion, I would consider that providing immediate counseling and therapy to someone who has experienced a sexual assault or thinks they've experienced sexual assault is more important to allow them to confront what's happened, heal, and then move on to the next step, which may or may not be reporting, depending on whether or not they're comfortable.
Well said. Thank you, Saba. Appreciate hearing from you. We'll hear from another listener, and that's Kat. Morning.
Hi, good morning. So I was a student at UC Berkeley. I was also in a sorority. I was a victim of sexual assault while I was there, and it went unreported. And I just had a few comments. The woman who'd been speaking from the campus earlier saying that it was a subject that was more open and talked about. It may have changed. I graduated several years ago. But when I was there, you know, I think there was a lot of information out there about safe sexual practices and STDs and things like that. But I don't think there was a lot of information about how to report and about the process. And so that was, I think, the biggest reason why I didn't come forward. You know, it was a very private thing when it happened to me and obviously very difficult. And I didn't know a lot about how to go on from there. And I just didn't really want to have my privacy invaded anymore. I certainly hope it's different, but it was really difficult for me then. And I imagine, you know, still difficult for people going through it now. So,
Well, I'm sorry again for what you went through. And let me go to Katie Palmer on this, who again is with us from Cal Poly, a senior there. Did you feel, for the most part, or do young women at your campus feel that they can report and that, you know, it's encouraged even?
Yeah, so yeah, this is actually a response that kind of encompasses the last question as well as the previous one. So our campus in particular, our main focus is to provide support for those who have
experienced sexual assault and for the family and friends of those who have experienced sexual assault. And something that is so important in that is the education of the resources and the transparency that they're here. And so something that we really strive for every student who comes on our campus is to know right off the bat what sources are available. That being said, we offer counseling Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and we work very, very closely with our county Sexual Assault Resource Center, who offers 24/7 counseling. Mm-hmm. And so that is first and foremost our concern. And by default, because we are affiliated with the university, then those numbers go to the Dean of Students, which will then be published as our reporting numbers, if you will.
Okay. Thank you, Katie. What about campus police, Peter Novak?
So we don't involve campus police from the outset, or if we do, if a report is to be generated to public safety, we have a rape crisis counselor who goes with them to ensure that the mm-hmm. process is handled appropriately, is sensitive to the needs of the victim, and really throughout the entire investigation that the process is handled as sensitively as possible. So it's true. You need more training for everybody on campus.
Let me actually go to a tweet here from a listener who wants to know if, I don't know if either of you have the answer to this, is the task force looking at community colleges? Mm-hmm. Some community colleges are just as large in student numbers.
They are. The difference with community colleges is that they have a large commuter student population. They don't have as many residents on campus. And so you've got different issues. A lot of assaults will happen at house parties off campus mm-hmm. instead. And the university still has an obligation to respond and to investigate to anything that happens off campus with any of its students, whether it was student on student or student, with someone else, a member of the community.
Another listener, a recent graduate of San Francisco State, says, will there be the same level of focus about general violent crimes on campus or just sexual crimes? And certainly we hope that we're talking broadly about violent crimes, period. Thank you both for being with us. Peter Novak, Vice Provost of Student Life at USF, and Rose Carlisle, Community Education Coordinator of Bay Area Women Against Rape. Thanks to Katie Palmer also for being with us this hour, senior at California Polytech State University, and to Claire Holmes from UC Berkeley, and to Jackie Spear, who is mobilizing a lot of effort on this score. And you can continue the discussion online. Our website is kqed.org/forum, and you merely need to click on this segment. Thank you for being with us this hour. We have another hour ahead. We're going to talk to Barbara Ehrenreich in the hour ahead, who is a well-known author of a couple of bestsellers, and she's writing about a very different subject with this new book. It's all about a mystical experience she had as a teenager. The book is called Living with a Wild God. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg, our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, and our engineer, Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Kresge.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.